This episode of Between the Rows was brought to you in part by Bayer. Bayer continues to make significant investments into the development of new breeding technologies and state-of-the-art cropping solutions to ensure the profitability and sustainability of your farm. This season, grow with confidence. Grow with Bayer. Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, Barb Glenn of The Western Producer fills us in on a head tax battle over feedlots in southern Alberta.
Feedlot owners, they continue to be upset and believe that this is an unfair tax because they are bearing the largest burden.
Shannon Van Rees of the Manitoba Cooperator reports on a new history book from the Dairy Farmers of Canada.
Some of these families who operate dairy farms are living in houses that their ancestors built in the 1700s, and they still have the same farm.
And Jade Marcus from Commodity News Service Canada pulls back the curtain on the markets.
Yeah, maybe there is this bigger production than Statistics Canada had thought, but how much of it is usable is kind of up in the air.
All on Between the Rows with this week's host, Ed White.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Ed White. Municipalities are always looking for ways to get money to pay for roads and other infrastructure. Often they can do little but beg provincial governments for more. But for the last couple of years, an Alberta county has been hitting up feedlots and farmers with special taxes. Recently, they had a partial court victory, and the Western Producer's Lethbridge reporter, Barb Glenn, is going to join us to fill us in a bit about what is happening there. So thanks very much for coming on the program, Barb.
Hi, Ed.
So can you give us a bit of a fill-in? It's a complicated situation, but where are we at right now?
Well, at the moment, as you note, the county was looking at a shortfall in funding for upgrades, so it implemented this. It's a per-animal unit tax, so it applies to more than feedlots. And in 2016, it was $3 per head. I am informed that in 2017, it's going to be reduced to $2.50 per head, or per animal unit, I should say. So this tax also applies to hog operations, poultry operations, and so forth. But because this is feedlot alley, essentially, the feedlot situation has gained the most publicity, if you will. So that tax was applied in 2016, and everyone paid it, so far as I know. and right now, the Cattle Feeders Association, the Alberta Cattle Feeders Association, is lobbying the provincial government to come up with a better solution than the one that the county has imposed.
Which county is this?
Lethbridge County, which is in southern Alberta.
And what kind of a county is that? Is that a mix of urban and rural, or is it all rural? Is this farmers imposing taxes on fellow farmers, or is it a little more complicated situation?
No, the county is all rural. There's a population of about 10,000 in the county itself, and it surrounds, of course, the city of Lethbridge. So, yeah, it's largely rural.
And where are we at in terms of the legal process? It's been kind of complicated to this point, and where is it now and where is it going?
The several feedlot owners, some of the larger ones in the county, filed a suit. The substance of that was that the county was not within its rights, if you will. It was not that the tax was not compliant with the Municipal Government Act. And so that court case was resolved at the end of April, and the judge ruled that the head tax, if you will, the per animal unit tax, was legal, but another tax that the county had imposed on farmland did not comply with the Municipal Government Act. So that was essentially thrown out.
And how seriously does this actually affect the viability of the feedlot operators, and what are they likely to do about this?
Feedlots are a margin business, as we all know. And in some years, they make money per animal. Some years, they lose money per animal. So I guess it depends on the markets. And feedlots are, of course, the whole cattle industry is fairly integrated with international markets, namely the United States. So they are subject to the market and have limited options for passing on any additional costs, such as this head tax represents.
And crop farmers seem to have dodged a bullet here. Is that a permanent reprieve for them, or is this a temporary victory?
I believe it's permanent, unless the county, I would assume that the county will examine the judge's ruling. The reason it was not deemed to be compliant was that the county wasn't specific enough in how it would spend the dollars collected. So I suppose there are ways around that. I haven't heard any. I haven't had any interviews with county officials regarding their future plan for that particular tax.
What are farmers saying about this?
Well, the feedlot owners are, of course, they continue to be upset and believe that this is an unfair tax because they are bearing the largest burden. The Reeve has told me that in some quarters it's a fairly popular solution to a funding problem because feedlots generate a lot of traffic and so the idea is user pay. Those who are using the road the most should pay the most. So, but I believe it has been quite divisive, and this is an election year, so county officials will have to defend that in some public forums this year.
And are other counties likely to follow this, to mimic this within Alberta?
I would think so. Most of them are in pretty much the same boat, needing road upgrades, bridge upgrades, various infrastructure upgrades, and needing money to pay for that. In Alberta, it's quite likely because with the downturn in the oil and gas sector, many counties and municipal districts are seeing a reduction in linear taxes. Those are the taxes that oil and gas companies pay for gas wells, oil wells, and general activity of that nature. So many of them are looking at tax roll shortfalls, so they will be looking at options.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Barb.
You're welcome, Ed.
Barb Glenn writes for the Western Producer in Lethbridge. Barb's stories and continuing coverage of this issue can be found at the Western Producer's website or in the Western Producer itself. Coming up in a few minutes, we will take a look at the question of whether or not Western Canada is going to run out of canola this summer and some other issues that people are talking about right now in the markets. This is Between the Rows. I'm Ed White. We're used to hearing about Canada's dairy industry in terms of controversy. There always seems to be controversy, whether it's amongst Canada's dairy producers themselves with the new milk pricing strategies, or between provinces over milk share, with a federal leadership campaign which has taken a run at supply management, or even recently with U.S. President Donald J. Trump taking some rather strong shots at the Canadian dairy industry during a visit to Wisconsin. But on Canada's 150th birthday, Canadian dairy farmers are trying to draw a bit of attention to a warmer part of the industry, which is the family farming aspect of Canadian dairy farming. And they have released a book, and Shannon Van Rays of the Manitoba Cooperator is here to tell us a bit about that book. So welcome to the show, Shannon.
Thanks, Ed.
So tell us about this book.
The book is really a neat look at dairy history across the country. So they feature a farmer from every province, not the territories, unfortunately. And it really gives a window into how far back the history goes. Farming often seems, I think, very new in Canada. 150 years for a country isn't that long. But the first dairy farm really dates back to about 1642. And some of these families who operate dairy farms are living in houses that their ancestors built built in the 1700s, and they still have the same farm. So it's a really interesting look back at where we were and where we've come.
And is this being put out specifically because of the 150-year birthday of Canada?
It is. In the past, they have done things on century farms and some of the history, but it's such a big celebration with the sesquicentennial that they really wanted to do something that showed their contributions to Canada's food landscape. So this is a look back, and it is specifically for the 150th.
I am very impressed that you know how to pronounce. Is it sesquicentennial?
It's sesquicentennial, yes.
Sesquicentennial.
Once you learn it, it will never leave you for some reason.
We all need to learn that this year. How do dairy farmers feel now about this multi-decade, over a century industry that they're in?
Well, it's interesting because nothing's been whitewashed. It is warm and fuzzy in a way. These are family farms, but they do acknowledge that, you know, Indigenous people have been farming here long before they did. And there's some very interesting and frankly progressive ideas about acknowledging that they're one part and there is a larger picture. So it's really refreshing to see that sort of acknowledgement, in a book. So, well, it is kind of the standard history, and there's great historical photos if that's what you're interested in. There is a fresh take, and they also look at the future, the role of, too much tillage in the 30s, and acknowledge that there were mistakes made, but that they're taking the best technology of the era and moving forward with it.
What was your favorite part of the book?
I'm going to go back to the pictures. I love the family portraits from people in the 1800s, early 1900s, and just to see that in some ways people look so different, and then you look at the faces and there isn't a difference. It's families just like today on the farm that you would see. So it's great to have that.
And this is not a book about dairy policy, which can be a frighteningly complicated matter, but is there a bit of a political subtext to this book?
I don't think there is. I mean, it's definitely marketing, let's be honest. Every commodity group wants to get their story out. You hear that phrase all the time. So this is definitely people getting their story out, but largely it's aimed at the dairy community. So every dairy producing household has received a copy. Everyone in the industry has received a copy. So I don't want to say it's entirely internal and anyone can get their own copy, but it's really aimed at, I think, reminding farmers themselves about where they've come from and where they're going.
And if you're not a dairy farmer and you're interested in this and you'd like to read about it, how do you get a copy?
That is the million-dollar question. You can actually go to Dairy Farmers of Canada's website. You can download a PDF, and they are taking requests if you want a hard copy. So you can email the addresses that are on their site.
Well, sounds like good reading. And thank you very much for joining us today, Shannon, and telling us about this book.
Thanks for having me.
Shannon Van Rays writes for the Manitoba Cooperator, and you can find her story in the paper or online. This is Between the Rows. I'm Ed White. Ever since the 2016 crop came in last fall, analysts and traders have been watching to see what happens when insatiable canola demand meets the very finite stocks of the Canadian canola crop. And on May 5th, Stats Canada gave us an updated view on where we are with canola and other crops. And Jade Marcus of Commodity News Service joins us now to describe the situation that we're facing as the old crop year winds down. So thanks very much for joining us today, Jade.
Thanks for having me.
So are we going to run out of canola?
Well, stocks are tight. We have 6.6 million tons left as of March 31st. It kind of depends on who you ask. I think that speculation is sort of the nature of the market. On one hand, some traders think that it is possible. We did use close to the amount that we have left last year, and canola sales are going at a faster pace this year. So the potential is there, but on the other hand, some traders think that the number is bigger than what StatsCan had said. They think that production was bigger than the report that came out months ago. So there's a bigger number that's out there and that we're working with. So some people think, no, we're not going to run out. And so while there is some clarity on the situation, there's still an element of uncertainty.
And how does all the canola that's still lying out in the field affect this situation?
Yeah, well, there's between 1 and 2 million acres of crops out there, and a lot of people aren't sure about exactly how much is out there, the quality of it. So that kind of factors into it too, that, yeah, maybe there is this bigger production than Statistics Canada had thought, but how much of it is usable is kind of up in the air, and how much that will kind of throw a kink into seeding as well as another question. And I think producers are kind of working through that right now.
Right now, there's a really big inversion between the old crop canola futures and new crop values. What are analysts telling you about whether that spread is likely to expand or contract?
Yeah, right now, old crop is more expensive, and it kind of goes back and forth, but they are worried about running out of the supplies, as we touched on. Plus, on the new crop side, the market's kind of expecting record production, so that's kind of pushing those values lower. But as we move into seeding and into the crop year, I think that new crop could kind of catch up if we see any issues with production or anything that kind of indicates that there could be some trouble with the coming crops.
And Canada is a really important part of the world pulse crop trade. What did the Stats Canada report say about where we're at with pulse crops?
Yeah, the interesting thing about the pulse crops, one thing on the lentil side, is that stocks look really, really heavy. They're almost double what they were a year ago, but when you kind of break that down, it's not actually as bad as it seems. Market participants say that we're pretty much all sold out of green lentils, and then a lot of what we have there are red lentils, which are, again, kind of in this uncertain condition. So maybe the supplies just aren't as big as they seem, and they're kind of looking to new crop as well. If there's any issues with that, there could be some big problems on the supply side. And as for peas, pea stocks are a bit higher than they were a year ago, but prices are actually moving a little higher, and that's because exports are a lot stronger than they were last year.
On paper, wheat stocks might not look much better than last year, but they might not actually be as bad as they seem. Is that right?
Yeah. When you look at it compared to a year ago, barley, all wheat, and durum were all higher on the year, but there's a few reasons why that's not actually as bearish as it seems. A lot of the crops, or a lot of those stocks, are feed grade, because it was super wet last year, and analysts expect that demand for feed grade grains could really be picking up into the summer. And on the durum side of things, the stocks numbers came in what was kind of expected. It was higher than last year, but below what analysts had expected, so that's giving pretty good indications that durum's being used up, and that's pretty supportive.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Jade, and filling us in on this complicated stock situation.
Thanks a lot.
Jade Marcus is a reporter with Commodity News Service. That's all for this week. Thanks for joining us on Between the Rows. I'm Ed White.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Between the Rows. Our goal at Bayer is to continue to progress our lineup of high-performing seed and crop protection solutions so that we can meet specific grower needs like yours. Because when it comes to your farm, Bayer is with you from beginning to end. Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.